Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
Deutschland hat erst vor kurzem begonnen, seine Vergangenheit aufzuarbeiten. Nicht die des 20. Jahrhunderts, sondern davor. Der deutsche Kolonialismus war ja lange ein Nischenthema. Inzwischen arbeiten aber nicht nur Museen öffentlichkeitswirksam auf, was die Deutschen in den Kolonien getan haben. In der Wissenschaft wird darüber schon seit Jahrzehnten intensiv diskutiert, vor allem in den sogenannten Postcolonial Studies. Die haben sich anfangs fokussiert auf die koloniale Beherrschung. In jüngster Zeit allerdings haben die Wissenschaftler ihren Blick etwas geweitet auf die gesellschaftlichen Verhältnisse insgesamt. Sie kritisieren, dass viele Regionen der Welt lange aus einer westlichen Perspektive gesehen wurden und ihnen Stereotype, zum Beispiel von einem exotischen Menschen, aufgedrückt wurden. Die postkolonialen Denker wollen deshalb kitschige Mythen über den Orient beerdigen, aber sie machen genau das Gegenteil. Das schreibt zumindest Vivek Chibber in seinem Buch »Die postkoloniale Theorie und das Gespenst des Kapitals«. Wenn Theoretiker vorgeben, Ost und West seien grundlegend verschieden, dann liegen sie einfach falsch, meint er. Chibber lehrt Soziologie an der New York University und ich wollte eingangs von ihm wissen, warum die postkolonialen Studien heute eigentlich erfolgreich sind. Welcome, it's a pleasure to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start with a very difficult or simple question, I don't know. Why are postcolonial studies influential today?
Well, they're influential mostly because of historical momentum, but also because of certain fields that have opened up in inquiry over the past 50 years or so. What we call postcolonial studies was really something that originated in the 1970s or so. And it originated in two streams. One was a historical stream, which was committed to understanding the recently decolonized world. And so in that sense, it was purely descriptive. It was simply trying to open up a new historiography of parts of the world that had not been very carefully studied so far. But the real core of postcolonial studies came through culture and literature in particular, where in English departments in the 1960s and 70s, the emerging literary achievements of the postcolonial world, Africa, Asia, some parts of Latin America, were for the first time being taken seriously. And, of course, all of the novels, all the literature coming out of that part of the world was focusing on the reality of that world. So it easily interacted and dovetailed with the work that was being done in history as well. So between the two of them, they started exploring the totality of the social complexities of the postcolonial world. Then around the 1980s, postcolonial studies also added a component, which was called postcolonial theory. And what the theory is trying to do at the time is not simply describe what's going on in Asia, in Africa, but also now come up with some sort of social explanation as to why the dynamics of development and the political cultures of those countries turned out to be so different from the West. Because, in fact, post-colonial states had a great deal of economic and social crises. Their economic development was taking a different path, it seemed. They had a much larger peasant culture. They had different kinds of political dynamics going on.
Would India be a good example for that?
Yeah, India was in fact an exemplar of the way in which it seemed there were some very deep differences in the political cultures of East and West. But the other, of course, was the recently decolonized Africa. And the two foci for postcolonial studies were Africa and South Asia, and to a lesser extent, the Middle East. Latin America was a much more recent entrant into the field. So the essence of it then was trying to first describe the postcolonial world and then try to understand through theory why it's different. So that was the two components of postcolonial studies and postcolonial theory. By now, there is a very deep institutionalized anchor that these fields have in American academia, because under the influence of the demands for taking the postcolonial world more seriously, under that influence, what we call area studies became much more influential. Area studies is the scholarship devoted to particular geographical regions of the world, South Asia, Middle East, etc. They're now in the elite universities a very strong anchor of area studies in history, anthropology, in some parts of political science. And they have become the centers now where postcolonial theory and postcolonial studies is practiced. So once you have an institutionalized anchor like that, it's not going to go away anytime soon.
Okay. What would you say are the most or some of the most important insights that we gain from postcolonial studies that we wouldn't have had otherwise? Are there some things where you think they crystallized an idea or something crystallized that people didn't see before?
Well, I would say there are two achievements. You should know I'm a critic of post-colonial studies, so in my view, there aren't that many achievements that it's
made.
That's
why I'm asking.
But there are a couple, especially in its earlier days. One was it highlighted the importance of imperialism and of the colonial legacy in particular, and how it left its imprint on these parts of the world, and both the brutality of the experience, which was important to overturn the notion that colonialism had a civilizing mission and that it brought democracy and peace and advancement to these parts of the world. Overturning that was very important. I think another important achievement has been in, as it were, mainstreaming the scholarship, the intellectual work, the insights coming from those parts of the world. My mother was an English PhD. She did her PhD in the 70s. And at that time, it was impossible in English departments to even read post-colonial literature, literature by authors born in Africa, born in South Asia, born in the Middle East, because it wasn't considered part of the canon. So too in history and historical scholarship. Post-colonial studies opened up these fields so that intellectual production could truly become globalized. And the professional understanding of these parts of the world no longer was the exclusive authority of Western academics. These are real achievements. Now, as to the actual insights, I think they've been very few.
Okay. One idea that also came up within this frame of post-colonial studies is the one of Orientalism. Edward Said coined the term Orientalism, and he meant that some people reproduce a very exotic portrayal of the East, the Orient mostly. Do you have an example for this, where this is at work today still, or where we see this?
Yeah, I think one very much comes across these notions, for example, when someone like George Bush Jr., when he invades Iraq, he says that the Iraqi people have to be educated in democracy. And what the United States is doing is exporting democracy. Now, he doesn't just mean that the U.S. is exporting certain institutions of democracy, like parliament or the U.S. Congress. What he means is that democracy is an essentially Western concept, and that there's something peculiar and particular to Western culture that motivates people to cherish and value democracy. And these things are lacking in Eastern culture. And the East, therefore, has to be schooled in why democracy is important. Eastern people have to be taught the value of democracy. Now, that's very different from saying that Eastern people have not been successful in actually institutionalizing democracy. That one can understand without being an Orientalist. You can just say that they have the same aspirations that people in the West do, but that their elites have been more successful in suppressing those aspirations. This is not what Orientalists say. What Orientalists say is they don't actually understand these things, and it's our job to help them understand. This today is an example of what in the 18th and 19th century was called the civilizing mission of the West, and that's how colonialism was justified. It wasn't justified on the basis of the wealth that it would bring to the West, because that would have been too clear a exposure of the real motivations. It was justified on the grounds of the good that it did for the people who were under its thumb. This is also what imperialism does today. It's the exact same thing. What makes it Orientalist is that it presents a view of the East as being, in a deep, fundamental sense, different from the West, not just in a superficial way that they have different eating habits or that they have different sorts of dress and they have different norms of comportment, but that they actually understand the world differently, different sense of time, different sense of space, these sorts of things. So it borders on calling them part of a different species. Now, the reason that this language is used is that if you conceptualize these populations as being so different from you, then the idea that they deserve the same rights as you doesn't come up. They become so different that the normal grounds on which you would object to social domination or social oppression in the West, those grounds don't apply in the East. That's why Orientalism was a very pernicious ideology.
Mm-hmm. And post-colonial thinkers wanted to criticize exactly this kind of Orientalism and the notion of Orientalism.
At first,
exactly. And now you're saying they failed and they're reviving it instead of burying it. Why?
Yes. My main criticism of post-colonial theory is that while it started out as a critique of racist views of the East, while it started out as that, it ended up actually revitalizing and reviving many of those same views. Said is a very good example of where it all started, actually. While the book Orientalism is a very long and very erudite exposition of all the different ways in which Western culture exoticized the East. At the same time, Saeed himself sets the foundations for reinventing the same views of the East and West. At the core of Orientalism, as I said, it exoticized and showed the East as being essentially different from the West. Well, the complement to that is also saying that the West is essentially different from the East, and the two cultures cannot understand each other because they have such different cognitive apparatuses, such different understandings of the world. Saeed says he's criticizing this, but at the same time, Saeed resurrects that same view when he says that the reason the West cannot understand the East is that from the very beginnings, from the time of the Greeks, he says, the West has never been able to develop an apparatus that's capable of understanding the East. Now, why would that be? How, over 4,000 years, can it be that one part of the world continually, nonstop, presents a distorted version of the other part of the world? Saeed seems to suggest that there's something in the Western mind that makes it unable to understand the East. Well, that's basically the same thing as saying that the East is so different from the West that we will never understand the natives. The natives are very different from us. That sets up a kind of pathway for post-colonial studies to return into the fold of this kind of exotic view of the world, whereas it started out criticizing that view of the world. And if you look at the pillars of post-colonial theory today, I would say that over the past 30 years, this is exactly what they've done. They've resurrected the view that the East is an unchanging, unalterable reality, essentially different from the West.
And you're saying, you're referring to the ideas of enlightenment, and you're saying there are universal capabilities of human beings, and they exist. And my question is, isn't there a criticism where people tell you you're doing exactly the same thing? You're going back to the old ideals. You're staying with the ideals of the Enlightenment.
Yes. Actually, I make no bones about it. I uphold the ideas of the Enlightenment.
And that, some argue, is a very Western invention.
Well, it happened in the West. But so look, physics also came out of the West, modern physics. The theory of relativity also came out of the West. Many medical inventions have come out of the West. We don't say that these, therefore, do not apply to the East. The key question in scientific advances is not where a theory is born, but whether or not the theory actually has universal applicability. And if you look at what the Enlightenment theories were trumpeting, the idea that there are some basic human needs that all of us have in common, the idea that the human beings are rational agents, the idea that it is possible for science to conquer superstition, all of these ideas can be found in the East and Eastern philosophy as well. It's just that they've been suppressed, and post-colonial theorists choose not to acknowledge them. Indian philosophy has a centuries-long tradition of rational discourse, of mathematical advances, of debates within logic, and so do Middle Eastern philosophers. It's just that what happened was under colonialism, this idea of Eastern philosophy being a mystical and spiritual philosophy became very, very common, and that's now, ironically, what's being trumpeted and upheld in the halls of post-colonial theory as well. So while the Enlightenment, yes, is originating in a certain part of the world, the ideas that it's developing are by no means specific to that part of the world. In fact, many of the ideas that the Enlightenment philosophers are developing, they took from Islamic philosophers, and that's been very well documented. So it's a pernicious notion that the Enlightenment somehow is a child of or a tool of imperialism. It was a genuine philosophical and scientific advance, and I think this is the key. You cannot have progressive politics without it.
I would like to focus now on the role of capitalism in post-colonial studies and the way it's being interpreted. One can say criticism of capitalism is very prevalent in this field. How would you say capitalism and colonialism are connected? You come from a very Marxist background, so this is a very tough question, I guess.
I mean, yeah, it is true that I come from a Marxist background, but I don't come to my views because of Marxism. It's that I come to Marxism because I think it happens to be correct. So on the issue of how capitalism and colonialism are connected, my views are actually quite mainstream in economic history. It's the post-colonial theorists who are deploying arguments that seems perhaps out of the mainstream. The way they're connected is quite simple, that the real spread of colonialism as a modern phenomenon comes as a consequence of capitalism, whereas what post-colonial theory has been sort of advancing is the view that it's capitalism that comes about because of colonialism. And the difficulty with that view is that historically, conquest and political domination across nations has been very common. But the real spread of the modern forms of imperialism comes under British rule and as a consequence of British expansion. The British Empire is fundamentally a creature of a capitalist England. Even the American Empire, if you look at the early to mid-17th century as a time when England expands into the U.S., it's already capitalist by then. So in terms of temporal sequencing, it's pretty clear that it's capitalism that's driving the colonial ventures, not the other way around. Now, in terms of one's view about the historical relationship, that's what it is. And then I think it enables you to see that colonialism was part of the modernization of England, and that it was part of the drive of England and the English ruling class to establish its hegemony both domestically and also globally. So that in a very short way is my view of the relationship between the two.
You're referring to the ghost of capitalism. What do you mean by that? Where is the ghost?
The ghost is this. Post-colonial theory is obsessed with capitalism, but it's obsessed with it in a way that a exorcist is obsessed with a demon. It's just they're trying to get rid of the concept, not because they're actually using the concept to illuminate something. But it's also a specter in the sense that while they're trying to exorcise that ghost, they can't. Post-colonial theory has never been able to go beyond capitalism. And there's two reasons for that. One is, if you're trying to understand the history of the Global South, you must take into account the spread of capitalism into that part of the world. And since they are trying, or at least they say they're trying to understand the Global South, they have to deal with the reality that the last 250 years of the history of the South is a history of its gradual incorporation into the capitalist economy. And the second reason they can't get rid of it is this. Postcolonial theory has tried to present itself as the lineal descendant of Marxist theory, in that it takes whatever is positive from Marxism, but it's also pushing out what it says is the Eurocentrism and the parochialism of Marxist theory. So it's constantly having to present itself as the alternative to Marxism, as the alternative to Marxist critique of capitalism. And it does that by showing that the way Marx understands capitalism and the way Marxists understand capitalism is inadequate. So it's constantly bouncing its arguments both off of Marxists and off of this notion of capitalism. That's fine. You can criticize anybody you want. That's how science advances. The problem is that in doing so, it's not that it's analyzing capitalism differently. What's made post-colonial theory, in my view, a very problematic theory is that it insists that capitalism is an inadequate concept for understanding the Global South, even while it admits that the South has been incorporated into a capitalist world. Now, how do you do that? How do you say that, yes, capitalism has spread into the South, but capitalism doesn't help us understand this reality? You can't. And they get caught up in that contradiction, and that's my view.
But are you then suggesting that we have to think capitalism differently or conceptualize it differently, approach it differently?
Well, of course, there'll be aspects of any capitalism that are different. That's not just with East-West. American capitalism has different institutional characteristics than German capitalism. And German capitalism is institutionally different from French capitalism. All capitalisms, when they take root in a certain country, adopt certain specific characteristics because of the peculiarities of that country. But the very fact that we call them capitalism means that they have certain commonalities across these institutional divisions. Otherwise, we wouldn't be calling them capitalism. So of course it's true that capitalism in India or Egypt or Brazil will look different than the capitalism of Manchester or the capitalism in Frankfurt. Of course that's true. But that doesn't mean it's not capitalism. The problem in post-colonial theory is that they insist there's a strong and a weak version. The weak version is they insist that this universal concept of capitalism has to be modified when you take it to the South, to which one says, yes, but that's true everywhere. It has to be modified whenever you go from one national border to another. There's no insight there. The strong version of the argument says that the very idea of capitalism is a Western concept, that Eastern realities cannot be captured by the idea of capitalism. And that's what I say is simply nonsense.
Why?
Because in all of these countries, the vast majority of the population gets up, puts on its clothes, and goes to work every day for a capitalist. That's how they earn their living. The most powerful elites in these countries are not feudal landlords. They're not tribal chieftains. They are the owners of businesses and the owners of corporations. Many of those corporations happen to be foreign corporations. The idea that you can understand India today, or the Indian state, without taking into account that all the power rests in the hands of the Ambanis, the Tatas, the large business houses. The idea that you could think that the BJP, the largest party in India right now, the ruling party, is not a party of big business means that you simply haven't even bothered to look for 5 minutes as to what's going on in that country. The idea that the vast majority of the Indian population right now has to work for a wage tells you that it's no longer a medieval economy. It is a modern, dare I say, capitalist economy. Yes, a capitalism that's different institutionally than that of the West, but that's still capitalist. So the notion that it's a Western concept that cannot illuminate the realities of the East is going back to these 19th century ideas that these brown people, these black people, are not built like us. They don't think like us. They don't talk like us. And therefore, the categories of capitalism, democracy, rationality, reason, science, all these categories that come out of the Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment, they don't do anything to illuminate the East. I think that's fundamentally obscurantist.
But are you then implying that capitalism has some kind of essence, that there is a universal essence of capitalism?
Obviously anything does.
And then anything does.
Every time you use a concept to say that this concept can be used to describe or to analyze many different settings, you're saying there's something specific about that concept that allows us to recognize it as being the same thing between one setting and another setting. That means there's some essential characteristics that it has across those settings in common. That's an uncontroversial statement. Most all science, all of natural science, works with some kind of, you might call it, essentialist categories. There's nothing controversial about that. It's only in cultural studies that it's controversial.
Some people are arguing that capitalism has a tendency to universalize or to homogenize things. So saying that, for example, with globalization, you can buy the same things in different places, in different countries, and there is less and less difference between the different countries or cultures. What is your view on that? Would you say it has this tendency?
Well, universalization and homogenization are two very different things. It is absolutely true that capitalism universalizes. Now, universalizing is a bit of jargon that is unnecessary. What we can say is capitalism has a tendency to spread across the world. Secondly, that as it spreads, it imposes certain common compulsions and common constraints across the world. So it's not only universalizing certain economic forms, it's also universalizing certain properties. The same way that when the flu spreads across a population, it's universalizing certain properties. That's why we recognize that it's the flu and not something else. But that doesn't mean that it homogenizes. There's a tendency to homogenize, for example, across a product line. So if I'm Nike and I'm making sneakers, the sneakers that I sell in Detroit will be the same sneakers that I sell in Mumbai. There'll be homogenization within the line. That's a different thing from saying that there's a homogenization across the culture. Those are two very different claims, because there are two ways in which capitalism doesn't homogenize the entire culture. One is, while it homogenizes within the same commodity or the same line, it also proliferates a huge number of new commodities and creates new commodities and therefore new use values, new goods constantly. It's creating them, it's creating new ones statically. That is, at any one given time, there's a lot of different things that you're selling, much more so than under pre-capitalist times. But also dynamically, over time, it's constantly innovating and bringing about new goods. So there is an internal drive towards heterogeneity as well within capitalism. But there's a second way in which capitalism doesn't homogenize, which is that it also leaves a lot of things alone. So when it goes from one culture to another, capitalists will try to take over and perhaps homogenize to some extent aspects of the world that it needs to control in order to make profits. If you go to an auto plant in Delhi, it'll be using many of the same techniques of management and production that it uses in Detroit. Okay, that's a homogenization within a certain domain. But capitalists have no interest whatsoever in your marriage ceremonies in India, in your festivals, in how you go about in your social circles. It'll leave those untouched as long as they don't in any way constrain the people showing up for work every day and your ability to make profits every day. things that don't interfere with that process, it leaves alone, which means that even as it's spreading across the world and to some extent imposing common constraints, it's also leaving aside, not touching, other parts of the culture, which persist in being heterogeneous and different from each other. The homogenization drive, therefore, is real. It isn't a fault of the theory that it stresses homogenization if the reality is being homogenized. But while this homogenization is occurring, there's also a heterogeneity that capitalism promotes and a heterogeneity that comes from the fact that it leaves many things alone. This notion, therefore, that a theory like, say, Marxist theory or other Enlightenment theories, insofar as they stress universalizing properties of capitalism, are also thereby denying the persistent differences across time and space. It's fundamentally flawed.
Okay, so now I would like to ask the question, how can we accurately describe what happened during colonialist times and after? And what kind of perspective can we have on that when we try to write history? Okay. How can we accurately describe the East and the West? And you're saying it's very legitimate to write a universal history of East and West. Why do you say that?
Well, I think there are two avenues to write a universal history. Now, first of all, we should be clear. What is the timeline that we're talking about? Universal histories can be thought of in two ways. One is the modern era, and what allows you to write a universal history is that the modern era is one in which the universal spread of capitalism has brought the globe under one overarching dynamic, which is the dynamic of capital accumulation and profit maximization. So many philosophers have thought about universal history as being more or less contemporaneous with capitalism, and Partho Chatterjee himself says that as capital spreads, you get a universal history of capital. So that would mean a universal history starts around, like, say, 1600 or something like that. But then there's also, you know, attempts to think about a common human history from earlier times, say from the time of settled agriculture. And what makes that a common universal history is something else. In my view, there's no reason you can't have a universal history from much earlier times than just capitalism. But whereas capitalism is the binding factor in the modern era, the factor that's binding in the longer span is class. And I think you will find that whenever you have after the development of settled agriculture, you have the emergence of classes and one group of people living off the labor of another by extracting a surplus. They're quite common dynamics, actually. Pre-capitalist India, the ruling elites of pre-capitalist India employ very similar methods and very similar techniques in legitimating and maintaining their rule, as do the Ottomans, as do the Safavids, and as do feudal lords in Europe. The proof is in the pudding. If you look at the historiography of the global South that emerged since the 1940s and 50s, prior to the rise of post-colonial theory, what you see is medieval India is being explained in ways and often being compared to medieval Europe. The Middle East and its great empires are being compared to the great empires of Europe once again. Okay, what does this tell us? Is that historians, without having thought very deeply and very long about epistemology and post, what they're finding is that many of the same baseline categories and frameworks that are used to understand one part of the world are also quite useful in understanding another part of the world. Well, that tells you there's something like a universal history at a certain level of generality. The worry that a lot of people have is that once you think there's a universal history, you're erasing differences. But that's just, sorry to say this, idiotic.
Why?
Because look at any science. If you look at the science, for example, evolutionary biology, when you understand species, species have elements in common. But the recognition that two organisms belong to the same species doesn't fool biologists into thinking that they're the exact same thing. They still recognize the specificities of those organisms. I would like to think that historians can at least be as smart as biologists, and perhaps even anthropologists and sociologists can be that smart, if natural scientists are able to use universal categories and still recognize differences, then why can't we? I think it's a pretty simple exercise.
But isn't there a danger of using a grand narrative or producing a grand narrative, like one big story, so to speak, where you don't hear the individual voices?
grand narratives are meant to erase individual voices. There's nothing wrong with that. If you generalize, if you're saying, if there is in fact an overarching story, if there is in fact common themes across individual cases.
But who can determine that?
The analyst, obviously. I mean, that's what social analysis does. Social analysis is about some people sitting down and saying, is the course of human history just an endless series of random events? Or is the course of human history also amenable to some sort of analysis where it isn't God driving it forward, it's not a spiritual being driving it forward, but there are common themes in human history that enable us to understand that human societies, human civilizations face similar problems, and that human beings have tried to address those problems. And then we have to ask, are the attempts to address the problems, have they had similar common attributes to them? If the answer is yes, then you have no option, no choice but to recognize that there is a universal history. Now, in my view, there is a universal history, which is the struggle for the oppressed and the exploited to find a voice for themselves, whether they're brown, black, yellow, or purple. That is the commonality of human history, of struggling against, on the one hand, scarcity, and on the other hand, their local elites, their local ruling classes, who have managed to put themselves in a superior position over them. And the astounding thing about human beings, what I think is truly amazing, and what I think any reasonable scholar has to admit, is that wherever they find themselves oppressed, dominated, or exploited, they fight against it, regardless of their culture, regardless of their region, regardless of their religion. Now, am I suppressing their voice when I say they fight against their own oppression? That's what post-colonial theorists say I'm doing. I find that an astonishing, absolutely astounding claim to make, that when you recognize real struggles against oppression, you're accused of erasing them? I have no idea what that means.
Maybe people are assuming that you're using old recipes, that you're going back to an idea of there is a universal narrative, there is a story with a telos at the end.
It's an empirical... Yes, a telos suggests a predetermined end, and that we should reject. But a universal drive? It's an empirical question. So my view in the book that I wrote, and I would challenge anyone to show, is that it's false. Show me that it's false that when Indians or Arabs or indigenous populations are confronted with real domination, show me it's false that I say they will resist it. It's never been true anywhere. If they did not resist it, you wouldn't need apparatuses of control. You wouldn't need the state. You wouldn't need to have all these mechanisms that elites have used to maintain their control. The fact that every society has them means every ruling class worries about resistance and about rebellion. Okay, that's a universal history. And I'm not pulling that out of my head. That's a recognition of an empirical reality. And I should say this, until the 1980s, that was the essence of what it meant to be on the left. You recognize this and you join in. You see the choice as being, do I stand aloof or do I join in? It's only since the 80s that people calling themselves radical, because of this dogmatic and quite sectarian refusal of all grand narratives, insist on not recognizing real facts where they in fact are true.
But the trend, one has to say, seems to be going in another direction, away from this grand narrative, away from universalist stories, yeah, more towards individualist stories, yeah, voices from that have a certain standpoint in this context. Mm. So what you're suggesting is, in a way, going back to,
yes,
what we used to do.
Not
Why?
Going back to 19th century conservative discourses, but going back to pre-post-colonial studies radicalism, a radicalism that I think came out of was an expression of real class struggles, but which post-colonial theory has spent 30 to 40 years now erasing. In my view, it is a gigantic step backward in social theory. And there's reasons for this. A post-colonial theory is the first radical theory that has and has had no connection with actual movements. It's entirely a creature of the academy. And it's no surprise that it has a kind of a disdain for the real struggles and the real achievements of those peoples. Now, I also happen to think that the worst is over, that the last 5 or 8 years have shown that the world is coming back to a more resistant and a more mobilized form, that real struggles are taking off again. And I think that if it keeps going this way, post-colonial theory will become a very curious thing practiced in some parts of the academy, but not taken that seriously anymore.
Where do you see these struggles coming up?
It's all over the global south. Right now, as we speak, Chile is in the midst of what could be a general strike. There has been an uproar in Ecuador. There has been riots in Iraq and in Lebanon. That's just a latest incident in a 10-year arc of anti-neoliberal, anti-globalizing movements, starting with the Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street, the Bernie Sanders campaign, the massive emergence of Jeremy Corbyn, all of which is bringing together people, shockingly, of black, brown, and yellow provenance, who are recognizing the very common needs and aspirations that I have been trying to stress, which the era of neoliberalism suppressed. This notion that all you have is local stories, individual struggles, it's a perfect ideology suited to neoliberalism. It's Margaret Thatcher saying there is no such thing as society. All there is individuals with their own individual needs, local differences. All of it is meant to erase the moral and cultural glue that binds us all together in a, I think, is a universal struggle against capital.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.